Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Divorce Friday. It's the podcast that answers your questions, financial questions about divorce. And today is our second episode of our alimony series that we started last Friday. And we are very happy to have another family law attorney guest speaker. Just one quick note, if you would like our contact information, please go to our website at divorcefriday.com. So today we have Andrea Wells with us. She is a family law attorney. She's been practicing law for over 20 years, which is amazing because that means she has been exposed to many different types of cases. And she is currently working with the Turco Legal, located in Newburyport, Massachusetts. So welcome, Andrea.
Thank you very much for having me.
So today's episode number two, we are going to be looking at what is an alimony case. So a lot of people know that alimony exists out there. And a lot of people who think they might be a recipient of alimony are going to say, okay, how much alimony do I get? And we're going to say, well, that depends, right, Chris? It's those two words. It depends.
Yeah, unfortunately, we come up with these answers a lot, you know, it depends.
Right.
It's true for legal and financial questions, but we'll defer the legal to Andrea.
Right. So
does it depend?
Yeah. I mean, so the question is, what makes a case an alimony case? And what I think we'll start off with first is actually what our statute says. So a lot of our guidelines and laws here in Massachusetts are guided by our statutes. And there's a part of the statute, it's in section 34, says alimony is the payment of support from a spouse who has the ability to pay to a spouse in need of support for a reasonable length of time under a court order. Okay, sounds pretty simple. We take that one step further due to the Alimony Reform Act, which I think we talked about last week, but we always seem to put that in there. There's a section 53 that states the amount of alimony should generally not exceed the recipient's need or 30 to 35% of the difference between the party's gross incomes established at the time of the order being issued. So, Andrea, what does that mean?
So what we need to look at when we're deciding whether or not alimony is appropriate in a case, one, we're starting where are the people's incomes? And we're talking about their gross incomes. We're talking about pretty much every source of income that you can think of. And there are some very specified things, but for the most part, let's just assume all of it, whether it's reportable, not reportable, everything is going into this pot. So what we need to say first, I think, is what is the payor or potential payor's ability to pay support to the recipient? Assuming that they have that ability, then we're now looking at, well, what is the recipient's need? And that being measured really by the marital lifestyle. And that is, you know, as of the time they are getting divorced. So we're not looking at a past history of their lifestyle, but what is their lifestyle right now? And if they have the ability to pay that, then it's pretty easy to determine whatever is needed to meet that person's need. The problem is, of course, one, we don't always have, and in most cases do not have, most divorcing couples do not have enough money to now maintain two distinct households, and both of them continue to live a certain lifestyle. So you really have to have some more extraordinary funds, and that's not the average person. So once we realize, well, we can't keep both of these people in the same position anymore, then we kind of have to start getting down more to the nitty-gritty. And what the court tends to do is a, you know, sort of a fair balancing of sacrifice between the two parties. Neither one of them is going to, in most cases, have that same lifestyle. So what's that balancing of the sacrifice for both of them? I think that the 30 to 35% that we have in the statute is really the court, the presumption that is the fair balance of sacrifice is going to often fall in that 30 to 35% of the difference in their incomes. Mm-hmm. You folks perhaps would, you know, can speak to the 30 to 35% any longer being the appropriate number. I don't know if we'll get into that today, but basically that was a statute that hasn't been updated, despite the fact that there's been some changes in the tax law. So frankly, on a day-to-day basis, the courts seem to be doing a lower number than that, probably more 22 to 28% as a rule of thumb. But currently the statute still says 30 to 35.
Yeah, and that does create a challenge because they have not updated those percentages and they just don't work anymore because there was the tax deductibility for the payor. And now that tax deductibility for alimony is gone, the payor is not getting that credit back in his taxable income. So now if you use those percentages, you definitely will not have an ability to pay. So I think when I attended a financial summit, shall we call it, and a lot of people were saying, well, you know, since we don't have those percentages updated yet, they're falling to need. You know, they're like, well, we need to establish need because that's actually the first thing the statute says. It says need or 30 to 35%. But I know that in the past, because need is so difficult to tease out and to parse, you know, to parse out and to be fair and, you know, not be subjective, we just have seen before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, we just deferred to the 30 to 35% because it was easier.
Right. I think it's a shortcut, right? And it's a lot easier, especially in a situation where we have a lot of discussion, a lot of disagreements, right? To just refer back to that number. Right. But I just wanted to address a quickie thing here, just so that our listeners can understand what we're talking about. It is when we talk about marital lifestyle, basically we talk about how they live, meaning how they spend their money. And that can be, it can be very different from household to household. And like you were mentioning, Andrea, is that in general, for most people, right, because they will have to maintain two households instead of one, they are not actually able to spend in the same way that they spent before, right? And so when we talk about need here, and we talk about the need of the person who's going to receive the alimony, right, how does that get resolved? That the marital lifestyle is going to be higher than the alimony will be able to provide.
Well, so I mean, in every case that goes before the court, and even if you were to mediate or come at it from a different angle, you do have to have a financial statement, and that financial statement is going to list your income, your assets, your liabilities, and importantly, your weekly expenses, which is a strange animal because most people don't pay their bills weekly, but we do talk in weekly numbers. So it's very important as a party for my clients to be as accurate as possible as to what those expenses are. And almost every client I have, you go through that and say, it's not just what, you know, the mortgage or the rent is and what, you know, your car payment is. There are a lot of small things where people spend their money. And when I look at someone's income and then I compare that to their expenses, you might immediately see a shortfall. Sometimes you see the opposite. Their expenses don't come anywhere near what their income is, you know, even after paying taxes. So, you know, I say to people, I don't think you drive down the highway throwing money out the window. That money goes somewhere, whether you put it into savings, whether you are spending it on anything, clothing, food, gas, all of those things, subscription services. There's a lot of little pieces where people do spend their money. So it's critical to evaluate that. It's hard. It's a pain for people to have to go through all their bills, look at their credit cards, look at their, you know, checking account and say, where do I spend my money? So the courts rely on that a lot. And I wouldn't call them necessarily easier cases, but for cases for, again, the average person who doesn't have $100,000 to take their case to trial, to really dig deep into all these expenses and prove those expenses or disprove those expenses, that ends up being what the court hangs its hat on a lot of times. And I think you're right, Chris, it often is this shortcut You know, we land in the middle. Is it 32.5%? And we just oftentimes have to simplify things because people just don't have the wherewithal to truly battle it out and get the need down to a precise number.
Yeah.
I mean, people like Diana and I will often tell clients, right, that the financial statement is so determining their expenses are is important, not just for the court, but also for themselves. Right? Because the court doesn't care about them after they're done with the divorce, right? But they should care about how they're going to survive after the divorce. So they should really know where these go, where the money goes. And one other thing that that seems to be stumping people is that sometimes there are expenses that, you know, maybe shouldn't be in there. How do we deal with that? Or maybe there are expenses that are extra. Like, so for instance, last week I was working with a case where the difference between the payor, the alimony, his ability to pay, and the cash flow that was happening was his contribution to 401k. Once if he were to stop contributing to 401k, then he would be able to pay alimony. How do things like that work out? Because obviously it's really hard.
Well, I mean, that to me is an important part of a lifestyle, that as a couple, they were making the decision to remove that money from their discretionary spending and to save it. Now, everything that had been saved, right, presumably would be divided in the divorce. But on the flip side, I often ask that to be built into the recipient as well. So just let's go with the standard. One party was the breadwinner and the other one was the stay-at-home parent. So only one person has been contributing. Well, that person that was is going to be the recipient, perhaps that's part of their need, is the ability to continue to start, you know, putting away their own money for retirement. So it doesn't always become a winning argument. And again, kind of depends on how much money there is to go around. But it doesn't also seem fair that one person can keep, you know, putting in a maximum 401k contribution and build up their retirement reserves while the other one is unable to do that.
Yeah.
So again, is it the fair balance of sacrifice, right?
Yeah. And before, when alimony was taxable income, it could be used as income to make a contribution to an IRA. For like someone who's a stay-at-home mom and just receiving alimony, but now that it's not taxable, if you don't have any other income between alimony and child support, you cannot contribute to an IRA or any kind of plan because it's not considered income.
So I'm not sure that's necessarily a disadvantage, actually.
Well, just saying that, you know, when I went through my own divorce, luckily I could contribute. I contributed to a Roth IRA at the time, small amount. Because I had taxable income, I was not working at the time. So, you know, these are the things that are difficult in that it's a case by case basis. But it, you know, I just want to keep going back again to the fact that we don't have a definition of need. The Alimony Reform Act did not define need or ability to pay, and that's why we're always having these conversations, because there is no definition. And that's why we have to like just keep always looking at these expenses. And Chris, this is a running theme. We've been doing this for how many, you know, about 2 years now, 3 years? Can't even remember. three seasons, I believe. And the running theme is, no, you have to know what your expenses are. You have to understand your cash flow. And so I think, you know,
that's actually a basic of financial planning, right?
It is, but people, but like Andrea was saying, people have a really hard time with everything else that's going on in the divorce, the emotional issues that they're dealing with and, you know, whatever else, having to sit down and go through, you know, a year of credit cards and bank statements to try to figure out what your lifestyle was or is a very difficult thing to do. And people do struggle with it. And I spend a lot of time with people getting them to understand what their expenses are, because again, it's either need for alimony or it's the ability to be able to afford to stay in the marital home if that's their choice. So all those things are so dependent upon expenses. And then we try to look at need, you know, and how to define it. Now, one thing that I think is interesting too that happens, and this is always a lot that happens in litigation, is that we say that the need is the lifestyle of during the marriage that is occurring now, today, not in the past. So what if they've been, you know, they know that divorce was coming and they stopped spending money, you know, and so now their lifestyle isn't really what their lifestyle was because now they're trying to save money because they're going through a divorce. Or on the flip side, one party is now spending all the money because, hey, if I spend it, I won't have to split it. So now all of a sudden one party is spending all this money and that wasn't really the lifestyle during the marriage. So how do we, yeah, how do we deal with that, those issues, which are very common?
I think if that is the case, I mean, most people are going to have some kind of paper trail, and then you do have to shift. The snapshot is not necessarily, you know, the month before, you know, appear in front of the court, that you would have to make those arguments. Say, this is new. Let's look at the last 5 years, what was being spent. And then, you know, the minute somebody files for divorce, things change. Now you could, to your point, have this very practical couple who says, we need to ratchet back and do it that way. But I still think you would kind of go into the, at least, and I tell clients sometimes it's almost like put your budget in there, right? And we can make footnotes and say, right now I can't meet these expenses or I'm not, you know, I'm paying my lawyer instead, but let's put the budget in there. So the court can at least understand the near term, what the lifestyle has been.
I think the law was pretty wise not to define need because it's such a
I don't know how they could.
Yeah.
It's such a fungible issue. But has there developed a consensus in the court as to what need means? Right. And I guess in particular, are there things that that there is a consensus about that is not a need? I'm thinking in terms of investment at Mohegan Sun, for instance, that's not a need.
That's a form of entertainment. So do you tell the person they can't get their Patriots season tickets if that's what they always did? Can you tell someone they can't go to the Maldives every year if that's what they did, right? So I can't say that the court has any particular consensus that way. If they've always done things like that, that it's going to count as need. And I, you know, a long time ago, actually, when I was working for the court, we had a case that, without saying people's names, I mean, Industrial Revolution, steel, oil, barons, that kind of wealth, generational wealth. And the need in that family was just so extraordinary. It was fascinating, actually, to say who would ever think that you're entitled to something like that? But in that particular case, that was the lifestyle. And you can have four homes and you can have staff and you can have, you know, stables and horse care. And I mean, it was really kind of, it was interesting. It was, and I was, you know, a poor recently out of law school student. So I found that fascinating. But, you know, there's other cases where they say someone has need, they live very frugally. They did everything they could to just save so they could send their kids to college and they're hardworking and industrious. And there is a need for alimony, but there's also no ability to pay. There's no money, right? So even though there's a need, it can't even always be met at all.
Yeah.
And again, the sacrifice can be pretty tough for some people. It's hard.
Yep. Yep. That's true. So, you know, again, so all right, need, you know, I was reading something where a judge had a case in front of him. And he was looking at the vacations, the entertainment, and a lot of those streaming service subscriptions that you mentioned earlier, Andrea. And the judge threw them out and said, this is not your need. So I have heard that judges can do that.
Well, so, you know, I mean, the judge has a lot of discretion, of course, to decide for themselves. And to that judge, maybe that was the sacrifice. Listen, you want to go, you know, subscribe to Netflix, you certainly can, but then you might have to give something else up. But when the court has to do it, again, these are cases that actually not only went to trial, but were then appealed, because those are the decisions that we get for the most part. So, you know, the judge has a lot of discretion to say, I find these expenses to be credible. And here's the credible expenses for the payor. Here's the credible expenses for the recipient. And I may not be able to award an amount that allows the recipient to meet their shortfall. And so I could see them sort of line-iting some things just to support their decision that they think that that is, either they didn't find it to be credible at all, that, you know, there was most recently, you know, joined the country club or something like that, or they made their own judgments based on the testimony. And so it's a little sometimes hard to know what was said in the court to determine that. But yeah, I think that the judge has so much discretion to decide what's reasonable, what's not reasonable, and whether people are credible in their disclosures.
Right, which I think goes back to the point that when people are filling out those financial statements, they should not inflate anything.
if you're called to task, you're going to have a hard time, you know, showing that you spent X on groceries if you can't come up with a single grocery receipt that proves it.
You know, because I hear that all the time, the opposing counsel saying, you know, well, or the other spouse saying he or she doesn't spend that kind of money. We don't do that. That's ridiculous. You know, and I am always telling my clients, please be honest. That's why I ask them, go back at least 8 months to your credit card statements, your bank statements, and, you know, really try to figure out what your average monthly grocery bill is. You know, what is your, make sure you really know what it takes to maintain your car and, you know, your household and your personal, you know, clothing and personal care and all that. It's really important, and not to overinflate it. Now, one thing that I found interesting about when we talk about ability to pay is that before the Alimony Reform Act, alimony was a function of dividing up the available income and not dealing with the day-to-day expenses. And I remember, because the Alimony Reform Act was, what, 2012?
11.
11?
It became effective in 2012.
Right. And I had just gotten divorced in 2009. So I was actually very concerned about it, you know, whether or not I would be grandfathered in. But prior to that, they looked at income. It was a third, a third, a third, kind of like the way we do college paying right now. But a third to the husband, a third to the wife, and a third to taxes. So that was kind of the thought process before the Alimony Reform Act. Chris, you just made a face at me. But
I wouldn't dare.
But that a third, a third, a third lines up with when you look at a financial analysis and you do you look at the percentage of gross income, like what party is receiving percentage of the gross income. Typically, and I'm just going to say typically, the payor has 60% of the gross income. The recipient typically has 40%. So that's kind of along that third, a third, a third, because out of that 60% of the gross income, he's going to pay taxes. He or she is going to pay taxes. So it ends up being a third to the husband, a third to the wife or whoever's paying, and a third to taxes. Is that kind of, I mean, that's...
I think rule of thumbs are really useful. Because it allows us to get to a solution faster. And I'm sorry if I was making your face, it was an involuntary reaction. I deal a lot with tax issues, with different kind of cases. And what I learned is that a third, a third, a third is a really blunt instrument, or any kind of rule of thumb like that is a very blunt instrument, because it works some of the time, but it doesn't really work most of the time. In some cases, it really, really doesn't work.
Right.
So you could have, even with people who have a very nice high income, they could in fact pay not that much taxes, depending on how their income is structured. Right. And famously, Warren Buffett says that his secretary pays less taxes than he does. I'm sorry, more taxes than
more
he does.
More taxes, yeah.
On a percentage basis, obviously.
Yep. No.
And these kind of things is not unusual, right? So I would say, you know, there is a need to go a little bit deeper sometimes.
Yep.
I mean, you know, there were a lot of different things, you know, that were going around before they reformed the alimony statutory provisions. But, you know, one of the judges had a formula that I don't even want to remember, but it was 1.8 sticks in my head, right? I mean, so we had some math to try to do a balancing. So some judges would use that formula, others wouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame if somebody has to pay a third in taxes, but I haven't seen that in quite some time. And
right. I mean, like I said,
you know, we know how that works, right? Is that paying a third in taxes. So if we have the 5% state tax here, that means 28% for federal tax. That's not terribly unusual people who make wages, right? Mm-hmm. But if you are, say, a VC, a venture capitalist, and your income is based on something called carried interest, your tax rate is going to be a lot less, mm-hmm. right? And they're going to make tons of money and not pay that much taxes. And, you know, I mean, you're right, a third to taxes is a shame, but it's what happens to a lot of wage earners.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. The other thing I guess to think about too is when the court's deciding this balance, you know, there's a number of factors that they have to look at in sort of setting an amount, and also, you know, for how long might alimony be paid. And, you know, the length of the marriage is a very big one. For the court to even consider alimony on a very short-term marriage, it becomes much more unlikely, regardless of people's income and need and whatnot. But, you know, how old they are, you know, their health, whether they're employed, all of those things come into it, not just what's the marital lifestyle,
right.
But they're kind of looking at that globally, is where do these people land? The last thing they want is for folks to have to come back later on, because, you know, we can look down the road a little bit and, you know, you're making some guesses, but we want to be able to do that so that we can have some finality for people, that they understand what, you know, how they move forward and what their finances are going to be. So you can't kind of forget that too. It's not just simply a function of math. I mean, the court does have other things that they can be looking at to determine how we balance what each of them have. And again, if one person can continue to work, they're going to be able to, you know, add to their assets, where somebody else might have to be spending down their assets just to make up any shortfall. So things like that, the court is looking at as well.
Yeah. So those are what we call the Section 34 factors.
Well, not only that, but there's a different, you know, with the Alimony Reform Act in 53, Section 53 has its own list specifically for alimony, where 34 could also be, you know, division of assets.
Yep.
Right. So they're very similar, but there's a couple of nuance between mm-hmm. the two. So,
right. And it's always helpful for people to go look at our general laws, even though sometimes they're very hard to decipher, but at least.
right.
Something that bugs me sometimes, right, is that we look at things such as alimony or child support, for that matter, as something in the very short term. But sometimes we can sort of see in the future, right? And especially nowadays, right? So we're having 7% inflation. I think 7.9 is the latest number. Yep. And so essentially what it means is that by and large, a recipient of alimony, their alimony is going to be worth 8% less next year, right? And potentially another few percent less the year after. And in general, we don't take that into consideration, right? And should we?
Well, I'll ask the question, is it also impacting the payor? Their dollars go less as well. So their ability to pay, does that go down?
Yeah. I mean, does it wash each other out, right, essentially?
It could. It could, in fact, their ability to pay may get reduced. But in general, what happens in inflationary times is that wages get adjusted, never as fast as people would like to, but they do.
That's true.
Right. That's true. You know, and we have some alimony when we agree, and not necessarily what a judge would order. We can ask for COLAs, for cost of living adjustments, to be built into that. But as a general rule too, the court isn't able to continue to do what we call a self-modifying order. So when we talk about 30-35%, let's just say the court said it was going to be 30% of the difference, and that every year you're going to relook at that, and I continue to have to pay or I get to receive more alimony as somebody's income goes up. And the court really doesn't have the authority to do that, except in some extraordinary circumstances. So what happens is today the income is $2,000 a week versus $1,000 a week. There's a $1,000 difference. So $300 a week is the alimony order. That alimony order is going to stay, right? It's not going to keep if incomes change. So people end up having to come back to court if there are changes in circumstances, like could be as simple as inflation, but changes in income. Does that make sense? That it isn't ongoing, or we're always recalculating it. You can agree to something like that, but the court isn't going to order that. You're going to get a flat number. And until that changes, because something in the future changes, that's where it lands.
Yeah. But if you're in mediation, let's just, say mediation or collaborative, and that's, you have that written into your agreement that you're going to do a true up every year, then that is possible.
Yes. Yeah. The court can approve something like that. And I've had cases that have worked like that, and it's been, it's been great.
Yeah,
and then for other people, they kind of rethink what they decided to do when they realize how that changes.
In fact, I think one of the advantages of these kind of agreements is that alimony can be adjusted upward, or it can be adjusted downward. So it can adapt to the circumstances. And it's something that I think that people should really consider.
The downside to doing it is because now we're sort of predetermining somebody's need. And there was a case where the judge just did that, and said, oh, well, there's, the husband in that case had been, rising up through the ranks and substantial, increases in income. And the court had awarded a flat percentage. And, the wife's need was being measured as their marital lifestyle, not the theoretical increased lifestyle that she would have been entitled to if they had stayed married. So that's, again, people can agree to do that. But depending on what side of the case you're on, you want to have that discussion about what that might look like, right? Because it could also harm someone if someone's income went down.
So. Yeah. Well, that's typically when they do like a cap on alimony, because it's the income that was earned, the income level that was enjoyed during the marriage. Right. And that's that eight, the question, does the ex-spouse, are they entitled to receive extra money based on income earned after the divorce,
Right. And then the thing that can happen too, and maybe I'm going too off topic, but again, highly compensated people, if they know they have to pay a flat percentage, they can alter their compensation packages at times so that they pull income out of, what might be subject to an alimony order. So again, there can be a lot of different things that people need to think about, and there's still no one set rule of what's best in your case.
Yeah. Another thing, sorry, Chris, just before I forget, because I forget things, that another situation, and now I just forgot it. So let's say a long-term marriage, 20 years, and the wife, that's just going to say husband and wife, was home with the kids, which gave the husband the ability to move up in his career. And then you're at that point, they're in their late 40s, 50s, when the income really starts to go up, because they're in that, they're getting to the pinnacle of their career. And so the argument, the spouse isn't entitled to that increase, except that increase wouldn't happen unless they were married for those 20 years and he had the ability to go to work like he did. So there's that argument on that side too, that the wife did contribute to the fact that the husband is now at the pinnacle of his career and his income is much higher, because he might not have been there if he didn't have the ability to do that. And
I've made those arguments, but there is some case law that says in that particular case, I can't remember the name of it, but the husband was going to medical school, right, in the early years of their marriage. So she was making more than he was making. And the court decided we can't divide a degree, and we can't divide the increased income as a result of that degree, right? So the fallback is to start trying to do that balancing and looking at all the factors. That case hadn't been a particular, I think that was under a 10-year marriage at the time, but But I have made those arguments that, right, you wouldn't be in this position to have a trajectory if I hadn't been, you know, boosting you up all those years. So,
right.
I think the case that you're bringing up there is possibly something where a rehabilitative alimony might fit better than general alimony. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, I'm sorry, reimbursement alimony. What am I talking about?
Yeah,
right. but yeah, I mean, it seems so we're not able to divide the person's accomplishments, but shouldn't the ex-spouse benefit from essentially supporting that that marriage for many, many years? Right. And then they get divorced, and then all of a sudden they're a little bit left in the cold. I mean, it certainly feels like that. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's generally the direction that it goes, where the lower earning spouse will never get back on that trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, you know, again, the court isn't always, they're never just looking at alimony. We're also looking at, you know, division of assets. So that is another way that, you know, it's a global resolution where somebody might get a larger share of the assets in order to compensate for the fact that, you know, someone will do better in the future, expected to. I mean, anybody can hit lotto and that could change, you know, everything. But so we're not just doing alimony in a vacuum. There's other stuff. And of course, when there's children, you know, many, many cases, we don't even get to alimony because of the child support that's in place, right? And so we have to have some, you know, $400,000 is the first part for child support. So it's, as a rule of thumb, only we're looking at alimony if we're over those amounts. Now, if there aren't children, that's different. But that can also matter, that whether there's children and what the child support amount is.
So we're going to address that more at the, you know, future episode. Something that our conversation here brings about is the issue of people who have fungible incomes. And I think you brought that up, Andrea. And the most likely people for these kind of stuff are people who are business owners, where the income that they declare on their taxes may or may not be quite, the right income. I mean, not that they're cheating on their taxes. I'm not accusing them of that. I'm saying that a lot of the time you can do things when you're a business owner that you cannot when you are a wage earner. You can, in fact, reduce your taxable income, your declared income, essentially deferring the benefit to later, potentially after the divorce. How do we deal with this kind of stuff?
So in that case, you certainly want to make sure you have an attorney who's financially savvy, or bring in a financial professional to help you parse through business tax returns. And, you know, we can often exclude some things that we say, okay, this is a legitimate business expense and that should come out. Or we have a percentage, well, 50% of the X that you spend. So, but it counts, you know, if somebody is receiving a benefit, you know, perks, can actually count towards income for determining alimony. So you have to be very careful. It requires a little more, you know, forensic analysis of what are these expenses and are they legitimate? And so that we get to a business income that, to your point, is not what's reported on the tax return, you know, going through their schedules and it's just a little more complicated when you have to do that. And again, sometimes that's people resolve their cases because they don't have the wherewithal to do it, or they don't realize that they need to do that, and they shouldn't just say, "Okay, let's just pick a percentage," right? So, they're complicated when they're businesses and they're involved.
Right. Another thing, I mean, you mentioned earlier about how the courts don't like to do self-adjusting alimony orders, mm-hmm. and business income is often a variable income. I think your income, Diane's income, my income are pretty much variable income. We don't know for sure how much we're going to make this year. And is that being considered also by the court? Meaning that if we happen to make a lot more this year, shouldn't some of that go to the ex-spouse?
So it's that same argument. Is the recipient entitled to continue to, I say these terms loosely, but ride the coattails of someone's future mm-hmm. success? Yeah. You know, that's the question. So you're going to argue against that if you're the business owner and all of a sudden, right? Let's say you were, you know, whatever, some business that has just skyrocketed that you were smart enough to get in on smartphones, right? Before. And so, you know, your company has just skyrocketed, then you can come in and ask the court to modify that. But that I don't think the other person's need will have changed just because the other person has more money. Now, if they were shortchanged in the beginning because there wasn't the ability to pay, well, then of course, now we can show ability to pay. And then again, very few cases truly go to trial where the judge makes all that decision. We usually end up, you know, reaching an agreement on things. So in that kind of case, we often do a history. What are the last 5 years of this company? What have they done? And perhaps we have a flat number, right? So every week it's $300 because that's either the average, 5-year average or you know, some other formula. And perhaps there's an additional amount if, as, and when. So that if there were you know, whatever the typical fluctuating piece of their business might be, that might be one way that people can resolve things and have their own self-modifying, but maybe not necessarily capturing everything in perpetuity.
Yeah. So, Andrea, you and I have a case together right now that has a very complicated income structure. Mm-hmm. And that's what we are doing right now is, you know, we have a 5-year history and we're going to have some conversations as to what's a fair number to use.
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's so, almost as if the more that they have, the more exposure you have to alimony, the more complicated your case is probably going to be anyway, right?
Yes.
That you've got a set of facts that all these things come into play.
Yeah. Now, how about an example of a gray divorce, you know, for people, and let's go, you know, gray is over 50 and I kind of take umbrage to that, but, I have clients who are in their 70s, 75 and 72, and I'm always upset when I see a couple getting divorced at that age because, you know, they're retired. They both have pensions. You know, that's fixed income. They are actually getting Social Security, so I verified all that, and they are also getting some distributions from an IRA, but one party's income is significantly higher than the other, and the other party with the lower income, I just don't see. He wants to maintain the house and stay there, but I'm like, how is she going to pay rent? So we have now, and the assets are already, there are no other assets than the retirement assets. So in that situation, 70 and 75, could there be some alimony? Could there be something where he maybe subsidizes her rent? Because right now, with that income that she's got, she will not be able to pay rent. So what have you seen in situations like that? Because to explain to the audience is that typically alimony ends at the payor's full retirement age for Social Security, which if you're born after 1959 is going to be 67 years old.
Right. And, you know, a lot of attorneys that I know and the judges, they kind of can lock on that. Well, these people are over 67 years old, their full retirement age. I there's no alimony in that case, but I don't read the statute to say that almost has a presumption of the initial order at the time people are getting divorced. If they had been even 50 and we would have divided whatever retirement assets, we could have looked at what were they projected to get for Social Security. And so we can sort of put them on the same footing right then. And if there's alimony or not alimony, but if you've never done that, you've never divided those assets, then if the asset can be divided. So for example, it was a retirement account or sometimes even a pension, even if it's in pay status, we can still divide that.
Yes, of course.
And then the other spouse would get a share. And yeah, but you can still, it's still, or if it's not an asset, we're not dividing it, then yeah, you're looking at it as it's a stream of income. That's the arguments that I make, but no, it does sometimes take a little bit of nudging to get people to see it that way, because how else is it fair? One right. person is the sole, you know, income earner and has all of the retirement assets in their name. Well, that can't be that we, you know, send somebody off to the poorhouse. And they say that it's not fair in a long-term marriage to have one party be able to continue to live, you know, or a good lifestyle or an increased lifestyle while the other one goes down. That's just right. not what we do. So, but you have to put that out there.
Yeah.
So there is a case that I worked on, in fact, a couple of years ago, where we did. They were people over 70, and she actually had the pension, a very nice and healthy pension, right? And he was several years older than her, and the challenge was that if we were to take that pension and quadro it. According to the terms of the pension, when he dies, so he doesn't receive anything anymore, but it doesn't revert back to her. And so we used alimony as a way around that, where she would end up paying alimony. And statistically, not that anyone was doing anything about that, but statistically, if a man is older than a woman, there is a very good chance that she will outlive him. Yeah. Right? And so that was a way to... provide for the needs of the ex and yet not lose the entire benefit when he passes away. Right. So I think there are creative things that can be done there, mostly if it is mediated and not settled in court.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think alternative dispute resolution is really the way to go, you know, in a lot of situations, because you just never know what a judge is going to look at and what they're going to order. So,
right.
especially.
Yeah, you can make it be a lot more creative if you are able to come to an agreement outside of court than if you basically hand it over to a stranger and have them decide what's your need and what your ability to pay is and what your lifestyle is. So
that's the thing. Like there's an attorney I know, they always say, you want a state employee deciding your future?
No. I would never say that about a judge.
That's
a good one. That's a good line.
You really want a state employee deciding your future.
I mean, Diane, you and I are always, and I'm sure you too, Andrea, we always push people to try to do ADR when they can, if it's possible, if it's feasible at all. And I think that's a good line to use.
I use it a lot because, you know, when I went through my own divorce, my attorney would, you know, I was upset about something, some little thing really quite, you know, now I wasn't in the divorce business when I went through my own divorce. It's why I got into this. And my attorney said, you know, the judge doesn't care about you. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean they don't care about me? And he said, well, because they don't, you know, look at who they had to deal with before you. They had people that, you know, were suffering and in poverty, you know, poverty levels and all kinds of terrible things. They don't care about you. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, when I heard that, I was petrified then to ever go to court to let a judge rule on something because they didn't care about me.
I think it's true, right? Is that alimony addresses people who have enough means to even potentially pay it, right? And I think what we refer to as a first world problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
But from there to let's figure out that difference between need and ability to pay. Diane, you had a case that was sort of interesting because there is a large difference between of income between the two parties, and yet it was potentially problematic from an alimony standpoint. Tell us all about it.
Is that the one that we were just, the wife makes $350?
Yes.
Okay. So the wife was doing quite well, making $350,000. The husband was, his base was like 400, maybe a little higher, and then a bonus of at least another 100 or so. And so again, the wife, seeing she was more kind of focused on the fact that there was a disparity in their income, and she wanted to close that gap. And you know, she said, well, how do we close that? Don't we close that with alimony? And I said, well, what we need to see is, you know, again, is this an alimony case? And I looked, I'm looking at her income, like $350,000 is a lot of money. That's a lot of money to be making. And I said, I don't think there's any judge that would say this is an alimony case, because
he has the ability to pay, presumably at 550 to 600K.
Right. But, you know, I don't think that the judge would, you know, her need, she can support herself. And I think that's what a lot of the guidelines now are, from what I'm hearing. You know, they really do want people to be able to support themselves, and she can.
And so at 350K, you figure that she has no need.
I didn't think so.
What do you think, Andrea? Does she have
any? What I would say is that didn't sound like a very large disparity. And, you know, if he were making 2 million and she made 350, well, then I would say, well, no, 350, she does still have a need.
Right.
But, you know, it sounded like they were close enough that, alimony
she wanted
not be appropriate.
No, she wanted to equalize the income. And I said, we don't really do that.
Well, and I'll go back to the court kind of saying that the statute rather, that it's that the presumptive balancing is the 30 to 35%. It's not equalizing.
Rarely equalize.
What was done before? So I think we alluded to the fact that 30 to 35% is no longer operative because of a change in the tax law. But let's go back to 30 to 35% when we were saying that about a third goes to each parties and a third goes to Uncle Sam.
Right.
A smaller Massachusetts cousin. And but so if we're looking at that, isn't that effectively some form of equalizing? I mean, we're looking at two-thirds for the payor, right? But sure, but half of that is going to go to, or a lot of it is going to go to taxes, right?
Yep. Well, you know, we can argue this all day. We can go around and around and around.
We love doing that.
No, it's obviously people who are listening. There is no one answer, and we, you know, it's impossible to come up with an answer. And I think we've had a really good discussion here today. You know, gives some food for thought for people. I think just understanding, I think it's really important for people who are going through a divorce or contemplating it to be aware of these issues, you know, to say, hey, look, alimony is not a given, you know, so don't go into this with an expectation that you're going to get alimony, because you may not, you know, especially if there's children, and depending on the total income, there may just be child support, you know, so we have to really set expectations. And I think the only way to do that is to be informed, like what we're doing today, and understand that these issues exist, and, work with professionals like Chris and I, and professionals like Andrea, who can put the whole thing together and try to come up with something that's fair and equitable. So
sounds like wise words.
That's my take. So I think we're at the top of the hour here.
We're getting there.
So I just wanted to say TGIDF. So Andrea, that means thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. And thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Thank you for having me.
I really enjoy our conversations with our family law friends, because it really helps when we can all come together and come up with some really good ideas and some education for our people out there.
Yeah.
That was very good. All right, guys. Well, see you all in another episode of this Divorce Friday podcast.
Sounds good. Bye-bye.